there. Let's put the mic over where you can.
All right, shoot. What's on your mind? What would you? How would you like to respond to my thought this morning? That would be a good place to begin. Yes.
Would you discuss the relationship between the need we bring to mainstream politics and your concept of the call and how it will be related?
Well. I guess I had in mind to say that this morning, which I didn't say, is that one of the saving graces about this human situation is it's surprising how God can use the best we can bring, even though it might not be very good. Many a man has gone into the ministry for a very inferior motive and moved from that motive to more mature ones along the way. He seems to be he fishes with any bait, you might say. And he'll take, because this is true, because he seems to want to take us on any basis, therefore it behooves us to be very concerned about our motives. Now, I went into the ministry for very inferior motives. First place, I went into the Episcopal ministry because I was just fed up with the barrenness of church worship and so forth, that as I experienced it out in the country churches in the state of Washington, where things were pretty simple and pretty crude. And the glamour and the ritual and the drama and so on was very welcome to me at that time. And that was one of my motives. Well, that's not a worthy motive for the ministry. Yeah, I don't think it even had anything to do with worship. It was just something that satisfied me and appealed to me. And and then I had some others. I don't mind talking about them, but I just don't want to waste your time talking about them. Hi. What's your name?
Dara.
What?
Dara.
Dara? Dara Degnan, that's you, very euphonious. Yeah. Well, the call can be a call to almost anything in us. But we have the responsibility for growing, moving, getting insight about what our motives are and what's adequate and isn't adequate in the way of a motive, because our motives determine what happens. Is that in the area of your question? Do you want to ask more? You mean the original call is sufficient on whatever basis it's contracted? Oh, yeah.
You're saying we have to learn a lot of things as we go along.
Oh, yes. We have ought to have better and better and better reasons as we go along for what we're doing. as we understand our task, then we need better motives. And are you all hearing all right here with this? Do you mind this kind of a informal arrangement, any of you? Okay. Hi. You are?
Librarian.
Yes, you wrote to me. I remember. Yeah, that's right. And you are? That's right. Yeah, okay. Right. Yeah.
You can't have
Yeah.
To have dialogue.
Yeah.
But where do we become evangelists and share what we know of Christ and at the same time respecting the other person for what he knows and what he knows?
What was that? You mean as between a teacher and a pupil?
Yes.
In other words, what's behind your question? What?
Well, I see the dialogue between two people.
Yeah.
You see, are sharing back and forth. But there's surely times when one has to teach the other. And how is this mutual respect or equality still respected and still maintained?
Well, doesn't the teacher have to be open to being taught by the student?
Yes, of course he sure is. But he had knowledge that he must impart.
Yeah, you're thinking in terms of proportions, quantities, so on. I think the concept of dialogue is based on the realities of being. Yes, the teacher knows more, but it's not his business to transmit that to the other person, but to help the other person grow into it, to acquire it out of his own meanings, because a student learns not out of the teacher's meanings, but in relation to the meanings he brings to the learning. And therefore, the teacher has to respect the student just because he's there, not because of, just because of that he is, that he is a learner, that he is a person. And that's the basis of the respect. That concept I learned from Martin Buber. If you're interested in the implications of your question, I recommend that you turn to Martin Buber's essay on education in his volume Between Man and Man. That's a short essay, and is one of the most revealing bits of writing about education that I know anything about. He warns against condescension, which is an easy consequence of your awareness of the teacher's superiority. And the moment that begins to happen, then there's a barrier being set up by the teacher in the relationship between the student and the teacher, which impairs the student's capacity to learn from that teacher. And it's a paradoxical equality. You know, it's not equal like this. It's equal in terms of who each is. Each is a pilgrim from birth to life. Each has learned something. Each has more to learn. And the teacher has to understand his function as teacher in relation to the capacities of the student. The student is conditioned by the teacher is conditioned by the student. That's the equality. Am I making any sense?
Yes. Let me speak a little bit of the background of the question. I had a student here several years ago. A student several years ago was a missionary to the Muslims in Israel. And he's done a fine book on dialogue with Muslims. And I think it's under the same principle of this equality of sharing, of being willing to learn from the Muslim, his position of his faith. But my concern is in the distinctive Christian witness, when we must share a revelation that is done in history, a biblical revelation, culminating in Jesus Christ.
I understand the question, yes, but I raise another question. What is it that you have to share?
Christ.
Well, how do you share Christ? This, we're getting down to something that really needs to be understood. So often when I hear this, I don't know what you mean, but I'm going to test what you mean by what I'm going to say now. We think of sharing Christ as imparting information about him. But sharing Christ would be much more powerful by the way in which he treats the Muslim. I think one of the reasons why our missionary programs were not more successful, successful, what do we mean by that? But anyhow, we might have had a different result if we weren't so sure we had it and they didn't. As a result, and I've talked about this with missionaries, and some of them seem to think similarly, that too often we went over with the idea that they didn't have anything, and we had what they needed. And as we look back on that effort, it would have been a wonderful thing if the missionaries could have affirmed what they had and then began to relate to it out of the gospel. Now, that would have been a real sharing of Christ, because I'm pretty sure that's the way Christ would move into a... Well, that was the way he treated the Samaritans. These differences that we think are very important apparently weren't important to him. He didn't come with condescension. In you know that famous passage of St. Paul's where he emptied himself and became as we were, and emptied himself even to the point of death. That's the way he shared his Father's nature. And our educational approach is often not Christian. It's an imposition. It's a violation. It can be an affront, to put it mildly. And it apparently alienated. And out of it came wars. Now, you may not like this or may not agree with it, but I'm answering your questions out of my meanings as I see it. Now, feel free to respond to that. You can be as blunt with me as I was with you. Yeah. Right.
But I really probably knew to help the resenting Christ, the person, in a friendly exchange, in a dialogue exchange. And I think you give us some insight. Well, I wish you could think a little bit more.
Well, what I say has to be embodied in who I am and how I treat you. Now, you know very well that our nonverbal communication can contradict our verbal. And, I had a very dramatic experience of that in Brazil one time when I was there doing some teaching, and I had to use interpreters. I couldn't speak Portuguese or understand it. And one evening when I had off, I was taken down to a square in Rio de Janeiro, and there were, in the square, there were groups of people, and somebody was talking to each group. And we came up to one group where a man was very angrily haranguing the group about something, and we stood there for a few minutes, and I was impressed with how hostile he was. And as we walked away, I asked my friend what it was and what he was saying, and he was a gospel preacher. And I said, well, what was the subject of his sermon or address? And he said, love. Now, I had an advantage over the people who could understand Portuguese because I understood his real message. And my friend who was my host, who did speak English but who lived over there and who was so used to Portuguese, even he didn't get the real message. He was so surprised that that was what I got. Because he was trapped in the man's words. And, you know, there's a good deal of this in church life. You may not know, in spite of what you prepare to say, you may not know the message your people are really getting. Now, they may not really be aware of it consciously, but unconsciously, it's going on. Communication is a whole lot more complicated than we like to think. I'm not, wait a minute, I'm not with you yet.
Okay. I would like to get back to that last question.
Yeah.
Reminded me of some experiences in my own life.
Okay.
Of trying to listen to someone who was either very opinionated or very articulate in their opinion, and I didn't agree with it even.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to be able to be fair to them and fair to myself.
And what was your response to what you were experiencing?
It was a feeling of love.
Mm-hmm. And therefore you closed yourself to any truth that might be there.
The only thing I opened myself to was that I realized for the first time that I was on the other side of something that I had been a lot of time.
Well, you seem to know it better than I do. I remember I wrote that now. Thank you very much. Right, right. You're dead right about that. Yeah, meeting of meetings. Sure. Yeah. Yeah, it sure helps. Well, first place, you can remember that you don't need to be defensive about your own point of view. that'll keep you from being snowed by his. And one of the things we have to do in dialogue is to hear the meanings of the other with our meanings. And that means that the meanings behind what he's saying are as important as your meanings. Now, that I think you were suggesting that a moment ago. And that is half the battle. And you can, with that kind of a basis, there are a lot of mannerisms and stuff that goes along with people with strong convictions. You can just ignore and try to penetrate it and get into what's really important to them. Whereas if you react to their style or manner or aggressiveness or something like that, you're really more concerned about yourself. You see, then the other thing is that you have to be prepared in dialogue to allow other people to say no, to choose not to be in dialogue. Now, fanatics refuse to be in dialogue. And if that's the case, you just have to say, okay, that's your privilege, that's your freedom. I'm hurt, I'm sorry, I regret it, I wish it were different. But that's the way it is, and that, for the time being, if that's what you want, that I will accept. But I will try to keep the door open so that if in another time we want to reapproach each other, I will be open to it. That's the dialogical spirit. The dialogical spirit is not to get angry because somebody says no. Yeah, that's the animal in us. That's the ego in us that wants to punish. And we think we punish people by withdrawing. And they may be oblivious to our withdrawing and not get the benefit of the punishment. And so it's just, in other words, dialogue gives a person the capacity for equanimity, which I think is a valuable capacity, to not be disturbed as often as you are disturbed when you don't have equanimity. And yet equanimity is an open quality that can care. I mean, it's not that you're indifferent. But equanimity means that I care, but I can accept the hurt that I'm experiencing and not get angry. You see, hurt precedes anger. Is that helping you with it? Yeah, that's right. You have no right to interfere with their right to say no. Listen, pay attention. Yeah, that's right. I have seen people who began that way, who with this kind of treatment began to soften and began to be more often. I've often seen them get madder, more aggressive. You don't know what they're going to do. That's inside of them. You can't control it. Yeah, that's right. And your job is right there because of the way they are. Your job's right here in you because of the way they are. Get yourself in order so that you don't get fouled up and angry and impatient and develop some capacity for equanimity that can keep the door somewhat open for the possibility of dialogue, which at the moment seems very remote. Easier said than done, I would like to add. Yeah, sure. Okay. God love you for that, because that's just exactly what we are called to be and do. That's our vocation. Well, my desire, when I'm not out of control, my desire is to know where they're coming from. What's all the steam about? I may directly ask them, why are you so angry? Why are you so steamed up? What's behind what's going on? Anger, I may even say anger is a product of hurt, being hurt, and what's your hurt? And that is asking those kinds of questions is an act of compassion, you know, and it tells them that you're more concerned about them than you are about yourself. And this may change the climate of the relationship. It may also breed a tornado. Again, you don't know what you're going to happen, because the devil can get defensive too. I don't know, is that addressed to your question? I mean, do you want to pursue it anymore?
Yeah. Well, I would like to interest that, because not that easy to control myself when I dialogue with somebody. I feel hurt, I feel angry, you know, many, many times. In fact, I just learned that I care about myself more than I care about him. But how I overcome that? That not to care about my ego, but his well-being.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know that now.
And how to deal with it?
Well,
knowing it have a bottle, battle, right?
Well, what occurs to you to do about it?
Pardon me?
What occurs to you to do about your being more concerned for yourself and the other?
I think our ego, our pride, you know, our selfishness will come into play.
Well, don't you have any resources for dealing with those?
Yeah, that's what I like to know. Resources.
Well, I thought you would know some of them.
No.
You don't?
Very vague.
Well, if you know, if you have, that's what I would call an insight, which is, an insight is a recognition that there's something wrong with you and not with somebody else. You see? And that is a step forward. That's progress. Now, for lots of people, that condition is true, but they do not know it. They don't have it as an insight. It's a gain to know that that's the way it is. And therefore, one assumes that as a signal. Well, of course, one takes it to the Lord in prayer. I don't know whether you believe in prayer or not, but opening yourself to another being, whether it's divine or human, opening yourself to another being and confessing this. And I think if you're going to confess something like this, it's better to write it down, because as long as it's up here, it's just a thought. When you write it down, you've made it very specific and very concrete, and you ought to write it as thoroughly as possible, because that'll make it more indelible to you. Another thing that one can do is to tell the person in relation to whom you have this problem that is true, and share that with them, because maybe they have some insight or on their own, some thought about this relationship. Maybe they see something in you need to see. And the very act of sharing this with another person, I think, takes the power away from the thing that's troubling you. Am I being clear?
Yes.
You see?
Yeah.
These are some of the things you do. Hopefully God's going to help us. And that's an act of faith. But there's some things we can do that will help us, which we have to have faith that maybe these will help us. And I think spiritual growth is a process in which God helps us and we help ourselves, and our neighbor may have a contribution to make too. And if you get all three of these going, then transformation may begin to take place. Whereas if you keep this to yourself and just feel sad about it, nothing much may happen. Now, this is just the ABCs of that kind of process. Does that make any sense?
Yes, very concrete. Very helpful.
Yeah. I don't know, anybody else? This is a very common human problem. What? Okay.
It seems like that as I begin to dialogue in the process, that there are some things that I'm unsure of or I'm unaware of, that the dialogue also helps me. Is that what you said, right?
Yeah, it helps you and helps them.
So it's for both parties.
Although the process may can make things worse. We may have to go deep before we come up really for illumination. We may have to go into more darkness before we get more illumination. And it can break down. There's no guarantee that our efforts will be successful. You see, it doesn't mean many a person has, for instance, tried to be responsible dialoguers. Couples, for instance, husband and wife, to try to work out their relationship and fail and get a divorce. Dialogue is not a guarantee of success, but it's the only process I know that has a maximum possibility of reconciliation. Or unsnarling of, maybe I better stand up now with more people here. There's always a possibility with it that we're going to be able to deal with whatever difficulties we have and open up the resources of the participants to each other. Now consultation, counseling, and so on derive from that. You see, in marital counseling, it's not the dialogue between you and a couple that's going to solve the problem. Your role is not to be a principal in that dialogue. Your role is to be a midwife to their dialogue. My job, I always conceive it, is to get them to talk to each other, because what often happens in marital counseling is that the husband will tell me something awful about the wife, and the wife will tell me something awful about the husband, but what am I going to do with that? you know, that, and I have sometimes said to them, well, so what? Okay, what else is new? And they get hurt, kind of, and then I say, well, now, do you know why I said that? And put it that way. And maybe they do. Sometimes a couple is smart enough to say, well, yeah, I guess what you're saying is that the important dialogue is not with you, but with each other. Yeah, right on target. And then I say, okay, let's do it. So why don't you tell her what you just told me about her and see what she says? And then, so I become the midwife to their dialogue, and often what happens is that a couple, when they're estranged, don't talk about anything of any seriousness, about money and the kids and about the neighbors, maybe a little bit about the job and so on. But there's the great deep ontological stuff in their life that they are afraid to touch. And I conceive my job as a facilitator to dialogue to helping them have the courage to risk getting into that. And once they begin to get into it, often they have such a tremendous sense of relief and do it. But they couldn't initiate that process by themselves. Now the same thing is true of a lot of other relationships. This is what has to. I see this going on in Detroit in labor relations procedures. Somebody has to be there to get them to talk to each other. And I see the minister as being someone who is always on the alert to help people who are in trouble to solve their own problem, rather than being the one that's going to solve their problem, because I haven't any hope of solving anybody's problem. They've got to solve it themselves, but I can be a resource to that. And of course, you probably have learned this in whatever courses in counseling you've had, but I just want to reemphasize that. Now, I'm still talking in response to your having asked a question, but I haven't the foggiest idea whether I'm anywhere near your question. Well, can you give me an illustration? That would help a lot.
Well, the other day I was talking to a man who was working in the committee of the project, and I went over something with him, and he looked at me and he said, we really have a problem with that, don't you? And I asked him, and I said, yes, I do. And I didn't see him, but he did.
Well, did you find out from him how he saw the problem? Well, did you ask him for any help?
Yes, I did.
Well, okay. All right. There you are.
All right.
Yes, you do. You have to be voluntarily vulnerable, not involuntarily vulnerable. What? Oh, yes, sure. Sure. If you're really a part of a real dialogue, you can't help but be helped. It's inevitable. Because how often one gets an insight about oneself or an insight about something outside of yourself as a result of that real encounter with another. And they don't have to be your equal in, as you, somebody was raising a little while ago about knowledge. A child, those of you who have children know how often they can be right on target when you're way off target. They see and perceive sometimes more accurately than adults do. Isn't that right?
Yes.
Well, the question then is, can the parent, can the adult, can the older, the more mature, the more knowing one, humbly accept that? What?
That might be a problem.
Is that your problem?
Used to be.
Oh, used to be. Okay. Okay. Well, if you know it's your problem, then you've got something to go on. It's these people who have these problems and don't know they have them, that whose situation is pretty hopeless. Well, we've got a lot more people now. We ought to have a lot more questions.
We are talking about the initial call might not be sufficient.
What's that last you said?
Yeah, the initial call that prepare ourselves to be a minister. I get the hint that you imply that should be keep on renewing and forth. So.
Yeah, your sense of the call grows, which is inclusive of change in you. Is that?
What's the relation between the initial call and the renewing growth?
Well, it's the starter. And the new insight is the completing of the call. You see, we may think of God's call as being what's the phrase, once for all, kind of an event. But maybe that's only the beginning of his call. You see, he could be calling you in that first instance at a particular time and situation and relationship and so on. But other things are going to happen in your life through which he's going to call you to more understanding of what responding to his call originally meant. And so one gets this call, often a renewal of this call, or you can think of it as a completion of the call, the continuation of the call, all one's life. I look back on a good many years, and I see that very clearly, that the initial call was adequate for the time, place, person, and so on. But it wasn't adequate for what happened thereafter, forever, because a person's, as mine was, situation becomes more complicated. You're faced with new temptations, new responsibilities, new kinds of relationships, new authorities, and so on. And with all that addition, that increase, which is inevitable in life if you're living at all, is a means whereby you begin to understand that call differently, and therefore understand those events as being additions to the original call. That's the way I see it. Now, I don't know what your theology about the call is. I don't even know what my theology about the call is now. I guess my theology about the call is implicit in what I said. The older you get, the less you worry about your theology. It's all right to be heretical when you're old. Of course, there isn't any such thing as heresy now. Did you have your hand up?
You keep pushing and you keep going three-dimensional and you keep
more bogged down? Well, yeah, you can get more bogged down, but these things that I shared with you, you need to share with your people. The call isn't just for you. And they need the inspiration. And there's nothing wrong with inspiration. There's nothing wrong with the awareness that you've grown slack and that you're not operating under any kind of a discipline. That you really need to get on the frontiers of your learning again, for instance. You're just coasting on what you learned 10 years ago. Well, if you know that, then do something about it. You know, if you know that, you know what to do. And it takes guts. Guts and grace. That's my last word. I never thought of that. I think that's pretty good, don't you?